It's 10 o'clock p.m. Wednesday night, December 30, 1970. Local papers had this to say about tonight's episode of Rod Serling's Night Gallery. Woman leaving a sanitarium comes upon a house that has been the subject of her recurring dream, and a doctor ministers to his wealthy invalid sister. Neither logline sounds all that exciting, but this show liked to trick us. When the pilot feature had premiered more than a year earlier, it was coyly described by the same sources as three separate stories of strange human relationships, a real sucker punch when you consider that one of those stories was Eyes, starring Joan Crawford and Barry Sullivan, the first directorial home run for young director Steven Spielberg, and an unforgettable return to TV drama for writer and host Rod Serling. Do you realize that Rod Serling already had more than 70 TV and movie credits before the first episode of The Twilight Zone premiered? 70! Yet for many of us, that's where his real legacy began, and to some extent, dwells forever. Even triumphs like his scripts for 7 Days in May and Planet of the Apes somehow seemed less than his own because he didn't host them. This is Tom Wright's painting for The House, a remarkable distillation of the story. It tells us in advance that the house's front door leads to a staircase in our heroine's self. Even that male silhouette in the window will be explained. This opening shot of the house is so lovely. It reminds me powerfully of how Margot Robbie's Sharon Tate drives through the streets of Los Angeles in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And actress Joanna Pettit was one of Sharon Tate's closest friends. She actually lunched with her on the day she died. I assume you already know that The House is the story of a woman who dreams repeatedly of a house, a kind of familiar and beckoning place, a place she has never actually been before, but which somehow knows her. At present, we are seeing the dream. But later, our heroine will find this place in her reality and must come to terms with what that means. André Maurois' story, La Maison, first appeared in his 1946 collection Toujours l'inattendu arrive, which means the unexpected always happens. It's almost too short to be a short story, just slightly more than 800 words. You can find it online. Maurois wrote his story in a strange conflation of third and first person. A narrator relates the story, but it quotes another person directly until its next-to-last sentence. In translating Maurois' story to film, Serling's adaptation opens with a more purely first-person narration, but because it recounts a dream, it has the feel of something more indirect. It actually sounds more like the dense but neutral prose of someone like Alain Rogrier, whose game-like narratives often describe dwelling places that rest on clouds rather than solid ground. This door knocker has a vaguely sexual look about it, as often happens in dreams. Robert Prince's electronically treated score suggests something being played in an adjacent ballroom of the mind, perhaps for a birthday party where more than the lit candles are melting. Somehow Joanna Pettit seems made for slow motion, a chimera of the waning 1960s and dawning 1970s. Her peach chiffon garment catches the breeze just right and came from her own wardrobe. There is considerable room for doubt as to whether or not the story was wholly Maurois' own invention, as the same general idea seems to be ingrained into different cultures as urban or folk legend. When we read the opening words of Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, first published almost a decade earlier, do we not feel ourselves in the presence of the same idea? Last night, I dreamt I went to Manderley again. John Aston, who directed this episode, explained his cutting from the white interior of the house to the light being shown into Joanna Pettit's eye to Night Gallery historians Scott Skelton and Jim Benson. Quote, "That was my little symbolism. The implication is obvious later that she's the one in the house, that all this is playing out in her head. If you're looking for a clue to explain the story, that's the clue." End quote. Hello, I should belatedly introduce myself as author and critic Tim Lucas, first-generation Rod Serling and Night Gallery fan. Joanna Pettit, who plays our heroine Elaine Latimer, retired from acting in 1990, so she's no longer well-known today. However, at the time of filming, she was known for her work in such movies as The Group, The Night of the Generals, and Casino Royale, and for Playboy magazine pictorials that ran in 1967 and 1968. Her strongest body of work, however, was always for television, where she started out working on serious-minded shows like Route 66, The Fugitive, and Dr. Kildare, in which she played most unusually a terminal patient whose case was followed over 5 episodes, the last of which featured a rising young actor by the name of Jack Nicholson. Her psychiatrist at the Hidden Valley Sanitarium, Peter Mitchell, M.D., is played by Steve Franken, whom I tend to remember as a comic actor, probably due to his work on The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, The Patty Duke Show in Bewitched, and in a wonderful little science fiction movie called The Time Travelers, though he actually appeared in more dramatic roles, such as this one. He was born in New York in 1932, the son of a Hollywood press agent. He was only 14 when his mother died, a loss that left him with an ulcer, to which he attributed the look of pained condescension that somehow was especially noticeable in his comic roles. His work briefly ran parallel to Joanna Pettit's when he appeared on an episode of Dr. Kildare, and as a continuing character in 2 episodes of Mr. Novak, NBC's successful attempt to create something like Kildare, but set in a high school milieu. The latter days of both their careers found them either on The Love Boat or Fantasy Island. He died in August 2012 at the age of 80. Joanna Pettit was born in London in 1942 and soon relocated to Canada with her mother. Her father, a British World War II pilot, died in the line of duty. Intending to seek work as an artist, she moved to New York, where she followed her curiosity about the theater to the neighborhood playhouse, where she ended up studying acting under Sanford Meisner. Within just a couple of years, she went from serving as an understudy to winning the 1965 Theater World Award for her work in Poor Richard, opposite Alan Bates, who would remain her friend for life, and Gene Hackman. A woman of natural grace and elegance, she appeared in a number of inelegant movies, Welcome to Arrow Beach, The Evil, Black Commando, to name a few. The bulk of her work was in TV shows and TV movies that offered her few opportunities to build real characters. In some ways, Night Gallery might be the most important work she ended up doing in film. She ended up appearing in 4 episodes in all, so if Night Gallery has any female persona at all, it may well be her. This episode was followed by 2 second season episodes, the first of which was Keep in Touch, We'll Think of Something, in which she played opposite Alex Cord, whom she later married, and the second was The Caterpillar, arguably the scariest of all Night Gallery episodes, often misremembered by people as the Earwig. It starred her opposite Lawrence Harvey, who gives a truly agonized performance, and who would later direct and act opposite her again in Welcome to Arrow Beach. Her last episode was based on Fritz Leiber's story, The Girl with the Hungry Eyes, and gave her the opportunity to act alongside her director here, John Astin. An ironically comic bit part here for veteran character actress Almira Sessions, who had almost 200 acting credits going back to 1932. She was Mr. Potter's secretary in It's a Wonderful Life, one of the Snoopy ladies at Michelle's restaurant and the bishop's wife, and she played a key role in Chaplin's Monsieur Verdoux. The Flung magazine photograph of Elaine's dream house cuts to this familiar shot of Elaine driving, now played at the natural speed of life. I'm sure you've already watched this episode and know what's about to happen, but notice here how we get to feel the déjà vu inherent in the moment before Elaine does. We've been here. We've seen this before. This puts us in her shoes. Speaking of the locations, John Astin said, quote, "That winding road, the lake, it's all there. When I went on a location scout, obviously they wanted me to check it out to see if I could shoot it. That changed everything for me because I saw so many possibilities for angles. But the key to much of it was first Joanna Pettit. She was ideal for the role because she had that wistful beauty," end quote. The actual location was Amber Hills, a 48-acre ranch situated in Brentwood's Mandeville Canyon. It was built in the 1940s for opera singer John Charles Thomas and later owned by the married film actors Dick Powell and June Allison. No observer has yet been introduced, but we observe Elaine here from his point of view. Actor Paul Richards appears out of the shadows, seeming to materialize out of thin air because Elaine has need of some guidance. There is something unsettlingly odd and indirect about his manner. The sprawling property, which later became familiar to viewers of the TV series Heart to Heart, is presently for sale at an asking price of $28.5 million. The driveway runs for a quarter mile up to the main house, which alone covers some 12,000 feet. The property also has a guest house, a separate caretaker's cottage, a workshop, tennis court, and a well, and the lake even has its own waterfall. But it's the house that interests Elaine. Paul Richards was an interesting choice for this role. He gives his name as Peugeot, the only name from Serling's script that was finally used. He had set out to be true to André Maroy by setting the story in France, but that wouldn't work on a television budget. By allowing Richards to keep the name of Peugeot in the midst of American names, the segment slyly informs us that he's a proverbial man from another place.
You've been here?
No. That is not really.
Follow me, please.
When Elaine anticipates the interior of the house, noting that the next room is walnut paneled with a painting of a hunting scene overlooking a fireplace, the room she describes is somewhat reminiscent of the forbidding room seen in the haunted mirror segment of the 1946 horror anthology film Dead of Night. When Peugeot guides Elaine into the room, it has a much more benign feel than the room seen in Dead of Night, which has a blazing fireplace that gives it the feel of a room somewhere in hell. Come to think of it, Dead of Night's framing story is entirely built upon a man out driving in the country who sees a cottage that strikes him as familiar. Dead of Night, which is also available on disc from Kino Lorber with my commentary, wasn't the first horror anthology, but it is probably the most admired and celebrated, so it's an appropriate touchstone for Night Gallery. Paul Richards was born in Hollywood in 1924. He earned his master's in theater arts from UCLA. He was appearing in films and television since the early 1950s, though he was frequently cast as soldiers, outlaws, criminals, even showbiz types like René the Knife Thrower in Phantom of the Rue Morgue. There was something refined in Richards' demeanor that allowed him to portray men of refinement as well as hardened cynics. His films include Kiss Me Deadly, Monkey on My Back, The St. Valentine's Day Massacre, and Beneath the Planet of the Apes, in which he plays one of the mutants alongside Jeff Corey, who directed this episode's companion segment, Certain Shadows on the Wall. He near constantly appeared in Silver Age television, everything from One Step Beyond and Men into Space to Zorro, Gunsmoke, Perry Mason, Naked City, and The Untouchables. He was always up for working in westerns and crime programs, but after appearing in The Unknown Terror, he seems to have sharply steered away from other horror subjects. He never made a Twilight Zone or an Outer Limits, though he would have done great work in either one. He died in late 1974 at the age of only 50. It may surprise you to discover that the house was directed by John Astin, who of course is best known and dearly beloved as an actor on stage, screen, and television. He'll always be Gomez Adams, and for those lucky enough to have seen his one-man shows, he's been a remarkable ambassador for the works of Edgar Allan Poe. But about 2 years before this episode went into production, he took a six-month leave from working for other people and wrote, co-produced, and directed a 34-minute short film called Prelude, in which he starred with Victoria Shaw, Quinn O'Hara, and Karen Jensen. Prelude is just about impossible to see today, and it bears a certain resemblance to this story, so I want to describe it to you in some detail. Astin himself described it to Don Alpert of the Los Angeles Times as, quote, a story about a kind of love in America everybody experiences and no one talks about, end quote. In Prelude, a film that has very little dialogue, Astin played a man who can be seen sneak-reading Albert Camus' Resistance, Rebellion, and Death while at his job. It's the end of the week, and he receives his pay envelope and drives home in a broken-down car, a home that is also somewhat broken down. His wife and kids are abrasive, and they don't want to be touched. The wife sends him off to the supermarket, and when he gets there, its doors open for him, like the gates of heaven. There he sees books that he wants to read, albums that he wants to listen to, travel brochures to places he wants to visit, and pretty women abound. Writing for United Press International, Rick DeBrow reported that, quote, "No other film has captured as well the remarkable place in modern life that the supermarket fills, including the small, silent communications between strangers. And Prelude does all this with a sense of poetry and visual exuberance," end quote. At this point, our hapless shopper takes notice of a very good-looking and somewhat provocatively dressed young woman whom he follows for some time, but he could never quite make the hurdle of starting a conversation with her. Then he notices another woman who happens to have in her shopping cart a copy of Camus' Resistance, Rebellion, and Death. It must be fate. But again, he finds he cannot speak to her, so he begins to fill his own cart with things he hopes that she might see as being similarly kindred. Records, highbrow magazines, gourmet foods. Wordlessly, they leave the supermarket together, and he follows her to her car, working up the courage to finally say something. But she takes her bag to a car full of noisy brats and a snarling husband. She pauses, sees him, and the two sigh for one another, two soulmates passing in the parking lot. She touches his hand, and he leaves. The end. Astin said of the short, quote, "I wanted to create a piece of cinematic art just as people want to write a short story or paint a picture. A critic has called it a tragic comedy about the death of the American dream." I find that pretty satisfactory phrasing. I turned down everything else for 6 months and even put in my own money. I certainly don't regard it as a sacrifice, but as an extraordinary opportunity to live well. To my own way of thinking, that's what life is all about. We find a way to be truly ourselves, end quote. When Act One concludes with Elaine saying that she isn't buying the house in spite of the ghost, but perhaps because of it, what she is saying might well be analogous of what Astin was saying, that she is buying the house to better know herself as a confirmation of her individual reality. Prelude was very, very well received. It was screened at the San Francisco Film Festival, where it was accorded a standing ovation. It was booked into some venues in support of Mike Nichols' The Graduate during its first run in L.A. It got John Astin a contract with Universal Pictures, who tried to convince him to expand the extant footage into a full-length feature, which he resisted doing. And it was finally nominated for an Academy Award in the Best Short Subject Live-Action category. Astin remembered that for about 20 minutes he was the hottest thing in town, but despite the tremendous buzz his film generated, the Oscar ended up going to Charles Guggenheim's Robert Kennedy Remembered, perhaps for overwhelmingly sentimental reasons. If we look back at Astin's directorial credits to date, it may be surprising to realize that there are at least 30 of them. However, Prelude remains his only shot at directing something for theatrical exhibition. He's worked mainly in television, which is not where a director works to express himself. First shown in late 1968, Prelude remained in circulation through about 1972, when it played in support of Bob Einstein's political film satire, Another Fine Mess, during its Los Angeles playdates. According to John Astin, Rod Serling was not entirely happy with his teleplay for this story. Astin vehemently disagreed, but I have to admit I find the second act of this two-act tale far less substantial than the first. For example, the second act begins with a restatement of Elaine's dream. The sound of the knocker seems to wake her, but the knock is not repeated after she awakens. So what really draws her to the door before she hears the visiting car drive away? Had she heard the knock on the door when she was actually awake and no one was there? Now that would have been counted as a haunting. But the story never really shows us anything inside the house to manifest its haunted reputation. When Mr. Peugeot reasonably suggests that the sounds she heard might have been the fragment of a dream, Elaine takes somewhat more offense than she should. After all, she was napping, and she only heard the door knocker as her dream was in progress. As we saw, she was not propelled downstairs by any sound heard when she was conscious. Peugeot is dropping by as a friendly gesture, merely, but she rather coldly cuts him off and shuts the door in his face. But this inexplicable hostility becomes slightly more explicable when we consider exactly who or what Mr. Peugeot is or represents. He is himself a far colder presence than his kind words imply, and there is something about his general manner that is vague and indirect. But remember, he can see Elaine. He can communicate with Elaine. So he's less allied to real estate than to what we might call unreal estate. To give you my most concise explanation of who and what Peugeot really is, I'd have to tell you that this role was slightly miscast, and that it might well have been played by Rod Serling. Remember that in Tom Wright's painting for this segment, there is a male silhouette inside the house, but the house is a psychological projection of Elaine, so her resistance to him is something of a resistance to her own eureka about this place. As Elaine returns upstairs, she's momentarily startled by the outside sounds of Peugeot preparing to drive away, which are the same sounds she heard earlier as she was roused from sleep. To get away from Peugeot, Elaine invented a story of having telephone calls to make, but she does make one, a check-in call back to Dr. Peter Martin at Hidden Valley. If Elaine really is dead, who is Dr. Peter Martin to her? Someone that she can reach by telephone? My own interpretation is that he's the parallel to Peugeot, intuitive, free-thinking, and encouraging, whereas Peugeot is more detail and fact-oriented and ever so slightly wary. In other words, they represent the two sides of Elaine's mind, left brain, right brain.
I found my house. That's right. The house, Doctor, the one in my dream.
The purpose of such a call might be to shift the balance of power in their relationship over to her. She is calling him to boast that she has not only found the house that has been haunting her dreams, but is now actually living inside it. But if you stop and think about it, this same call, as viewed from Dr. Martin's side of things, would be analogous to having a patient declare that they were severing all ties with reality, that they have decided to simply inhabit their delusion, surrender to it, which might mean that Elaine had to die to become the ghost.
Dr. Mitchell, would you please hold on for just a minute? I'll be right back. There's someone at my door.
When she lays down the white receiver on the night table, the camera holds on its image for some time, and it's long been part of the language of cinema, at least since the silent days, that a dangling receiver, an abandoned receiver, represents the severed communication between the living and the dead. In this case, it may also represent her decision to sever all communication with reality. So why, when Elaine reaches the door and opens it, are we denied the episode's big zinger, which should be her opening the door to face her own self? Well, I suspect this would have seemed too crude to John Aston, that he chose deliberately to sidestep the cliched and predictable, that he felt it was better to impart the same information, but in a softer, more poetical way, more in the character of the episode as a whole. Also, we must remember that Elaine's dream is of recognizing the house, not of meeting herself there at its door, in some metaphysical way, because she is still ignorant of the causes and effects of her dream. She is still as much the person knocking on the door as the person answering it. Remember, she was in a sanitarium, and if she found the house upon her release, such a convenient discovery might well represent a total relapse into schizophrenia rather than her literal death. Though the fantasy she suffers from may be incorporating a ghost as a means of conveying to her a possible way out. Of this episode, John Aston told the authors of Rod Serling's Night Gallery, an after-hours tour, quote, "Its very ambiguity made it an even more powerfully didactic statement, and I think time has proven me correct because it is one of the episodes of Night Gallery you keep hearing about. The house remains, of the shows I directed and acted in, the one that gets the most commentary. I still get letters about it," end quote. After this, John Astin would direct two other Night Gallery segments, A Fear of Spiders, featuring Patrick O'Neill and Kim Stanley, and The Dark Boy, based on a story by August Derleff, featuring Elizabeth Hartman and Gail Sondergaard. I mentioned earlier that there were certain parallels between John Astin's Prelude and The House. These are not literal parallels. No one in Prelude is literally dead, but there is an acute feeling about its characters that they are bittersweetly conscious of not being fully alive in the lives they have chosen. In Astin's story, he uses Camus' Resistance, Rebellion, and Death as the identifier, the confirmation of his protagonist's deep affinity with the kindred spirit he encounters at the supermarket. It occurs to me that if Prelude were to be adapted as an episode of Night Gallery, it would fit the format surprisingly easily, were the premise to be taken just one step further by having the complaining husband in the station wagon with the kids, also played by Astin, then following a bewildered Astin home to the nagging of the wife we didn't see on screen earlier, who turns out to be portrayed by Victoria Shaw. The second and final segment of this episode is Certain Shadows on the Wall, another Rod Serling teleplay, this time based on the more plainly named The Shadows on the Wall, a story by Mary Eleanor Wilkins Freeman.
Perfect outline of a certain object at a certain given moment. This painting is called Certain Shadows on the Wall.
It may have inspired one of Tom Wright's less inspired Night Gallery paintings, but the episode itself has a memorable visual avatar of horror, a wall display that would have been well placed on display in the Night Gallery itself.
It's even awful, stealing through it, to think of the live people who've slept in the solitary bedrooms, to say nothing of the dead. Now is the time for shadow, when every corner is a cavern, and every downward step a pit, when the stained glass is reflected in pale and faded hues.
This image is foretold by this starkly lit opening shot in which Lewis Hayward, as Stephen Brigham, is reading some comforting lines from Charles Dickens' Bleak House to his ailing sister Emma, played by Mercury Theatre and Twilight Zone alumnus Agnes Moorehead.
The shadow in the long drawing room upon my lady's picture is the first to come.
Mary Eleanor Wilkins Freeman was born in 1852 and died in 1930, so she was both a 19th and 20th century author. Though she was not primarily an author of supernatural tales, she compiled an entire book's worth by 1903, when she was still unmarried and writing as Mary Wilkins. This, in addition to other volumes of short stories and somewhere in the neighborhood of 24 novels. Her first published short story, The Ghost Family, which appeared in 1881, was of supernatural character. The story on which this segment was based first appeared in the collection The Wind in the Rosebush and Other Stories of the Supernatural, published in 1903. The story has since been reprinted in numerous anthologies and collections of Wilkins' own weird fiction. Rod Serling expanded the original story considerably and modified the characters' names. In the short story, we get an account of the sisters Glynn, the eldest, Carolyn, who is, quote, tall, harshly thin, with a hard colorlessness of face, end quote. The nervous Rebecca Ann, also described as somewhat stout and roseate. And Emma, the only beauty of the family, who is now Mrs. Stephen Brigham. They have two brothers, Edward and Henry, or did until Edward died shortly before the story began to be told. Serling turned Edward into Emma, Carolyn into Anne, Henry into Stephen, and made Rebecca the pretty one, but a spinster nevertheless. And all the Glynns were given the family name of Brigham, so there was quite a lot of nominal tinkering. Based on what the story tells us of them, the characters, regardless of their names, are cast to perfection, and the entire segment can be counted as one of the series' genuine masterpieces of art direction, thanks to the craftsmanship of Joe Alves. His earlier work had been for the series The Name of the Game and Marcus Welby, M.D., just one or two episodes of each, but he supervised the art direction of 42 episodes of Night Gallery, and it was his association with Steven Spielberg during this season that took him into features, namely The Sugarland Express, Jaws, and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. In 1983, Alves would direct his only feature, the box office bomb, Jaws 3D. Agnes Moorehead has only this one scene in this segment. It's only 4 minutes of screen time, in which Lewis Hayward does most of the talking at that. But with this scene, she dominates the segment, and her closing gesture puts the seal on its central tapestry of terror.
Stop talking about it. It's becoming an obsessive preoccupation with you.
So nicely done. And it's one of those details that don't necessarily jump out at you until the second time you see it. William Margulies was the director of photography on all the first season episodes, and I think as we can see here, he brought out an exquisite likeness to Floyd Crosby's opulent, densely shadowed work on Roger Corman's Edgar Allan Poe films of the early 1960s. His outstanding credits, at least where I'm concerned, are the memorable Gunsmoke episode Dirt, written by Sam Peckinpah and directed by Ted Post, and the classic 1966 Don Knotts comedy The Ghost and Mr. Chicken. He also shot a couple of lesser Elvis movies, Easy Come, Easy Go and Clambake, as well as Voodoo Island with Boris Karloff and Pharaoh's Curse, and lots of series television, including Have Gun Will Travel, Thriller, The Alfred Hitchcock Hour, 16 of those, Philip Marlowe, starring Philip Carey, and 87th Precinct. A gorgeous shot this, especially with the blazing stained glass window in the wall, and almost everything we see being doubled in some manner by the starkest of shadows. As Hayward makes his way through this corridor to meet the rest of the cast, we can see that the shadows of these people are already baked into the walls of this house, long before their mayhem is committed. Lewis Hayward, of course, a British-American actor, born in South Africa in 1909, best remembered as the first Simon Templar, the saint, of the screen. He also starred in The Son of Monte Cristo, one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite movie sequels, and many other swashbucklers, as well as the classic Agatha Christie thriller, And Then There Were None. In the 1950s, he played another layman sleuth, the Lone Wolf, on television. Playing the sweet-natured Rebecca Brigham is the celebrated Welsh actress Rachel Roberts, one of the chief avatars of the British kitchen sink cinema movement, for her breakthrough roles in Carol Rice's Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, opposite Albert Finney, and Lindsay Anderson's This Sporting Life, opposite Richard Harris, in the early 1960s. Her sister Anne, called Carolyn in the story, and described as someone who speaks not with acrimony, but with grave severity, is Grayson Hall, known for her Oscar-nominated supporting role in The Night of the Iguana, and for the several characters she portrayed in the long-running daytime melodrama Dark Shadows.
And we all live here by her charitable sufferance.
Grayson Hall makes a somewhat disconcerting impression by saying her lines while looking directly into the camera, making the effect doubly disconcerting once Lewis Hayward takes a seat opposite her. Her eyeline seems to be looking directly toward him, which makes me wonder if her close-up was perhaps filmed before it was decided to have Hayward standing while delivering his initial lines. Either way, she makes an immediate, unsettling impression, as Grayson Hall often does. Hayward is surprising casting for this role, but he's actually a brilliant choice. We can see that Stephen is a theatrical extrovert, furtive in his scheming thoughts, but outwardly always a showman, putting the best face and five-fingered flourish on his actions as the man of the family. With him in this role, still somewhat mantled by the ghost of his swashbuckling days, there is simply no room in this story for a second Brigham brother. In 1961, Rachel Roberts married actor Rex Harrison and lost some of the momentum of her career. As she once noted, quote, "It's very difficult to be taken seriously when you're introduced at a party as the fourth Mrs. Rex Harrison," end quote. By the time this show was made, their marriage had just about hit the rocks, and she was attempting to rebuild her career with a go at Hollywood. After appearing in Doctor's Wives and The Wild Rovers, she won another outstanding role, actually more than one, in Oh Lucky Man, opposite Malcolm McDowell, a fruitful reunion with her Sporting Life director, Lindsay Anderson. This was followed by work in Murder on the Orient Express and Picnic at Hanging Rock. Tragically, she committed suicide at her home in Studio City in November 1980 at the age of only 53. When one looks back at many of her roles, including this one, it's easy to see behind her determined brightness, her warm and sweet domesticity, even her seductiveness, an abiding weight of sadness and tragedy. The costume designer for this segment, indeed for the show's entire first season, was Grady Hunt, whose television credits extended back to the 1950s with shows like the Colgate Comedy Hour and the George Burns Show. But this episode shows him to be an attentive costumer. Notice how Rebecca's flowery, old-fashioned dress exudes a feel of hominess, while her brother Stephen's suit is all business. One might go so far as to say, the funeral business. The wardrobe and set decoration departments are collaborating nicely here on the character of Anne, whose unnoticeable clothes seem to merge with the very antiquated decor of the room as she knits a bolt of overpowering blood red. She's the very opposite of Stephen, strutting around in black and white with gray spats no less. When he mentions that tuning the piano will help it to fetch a higher price, we cut to Rebecca. And this is also apparently the exact moment when Emma dies, of revulsion, perhaps. Rebecca's muted but florid colors tell us that she's a sweet lady devoted to home and family, while Anne literally fades into the wallpaper, cold and unfeeling. Agnes Moorehead is already out of the story so quickly I scarcely had time to remark on the great depth and breadth of her remarkable career in films and television. Never mind what you hear about Orson Welles' The Magnificent Ambersons being a great lost film. It's true that the version that survives is not the film he wanted us to see. But even if all you get out of it is Agnes Moorehead's supporting performance, you'll see her very best work. And that's well worth your time, as is the classic Twilight Zone episode The Invaders, an astonishing one-woman show in which she doesn't speak a single line. In some ways, this episode comes close to that, in that her character is now dead, but will linger on as an active presence through the very last shot of the segment. I don't think the subject comes up prior to this, but one of Rod Serling's cleverest touches in adapting this story was this little bit here when Stephen telephones the funeral director to notify him of Emma's death and identifies himself as Dr. Stephen Brigham. It's easy to accept him as a craven relative, but this sole detail works wonders at establishing an air of trust about him. It makes the whole situation of his looking after his sister that much more tidy. Can you imagine what Mario Bava might have done with an image like this? When Mary Wilkins conceived for her story, a shadow somehow burned by supernatural means into a papered wall as a lingering accusation. She was finding a new metaphor for the ceaselessly beating heart of the murder victim in Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart, first published in 1843. It's there as an undeniable, undismissible reproach of the medicinal love of Brother Stephen. Director Jeff Corey told the authors of Night Gallery, an after-hours tour, quote, "They had a wonderful artist who came in and painted that marvelous ephemeral shadow. You'd have to go up to it, even though you knew it was painted, to ascertain that it was painted, because it absolutely looked like Aggie's shadow. It was amazing," end quote. Certain Shadows on the Wall was the first of 10 Night Gallery segments that would be directed by Jeff Corey, who was one of the most respected acting teachers in the Los Angeles area. Born Arthur Zwirling in 1914, Corey had worked as a character actor in films since the late 1930s, and some of his best-known early screen appearances were actually uncredited. He's called Mr. Corey, and you'll find out with Boris Karloff, Peter Lorre, and Bela Lugosi, and he attempts to rob the crypt of Lawrence Talbot in the opening scene of Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. He was just beginning to crest in terms of credit and noticeability. For example, his standout role as Blinky in Robert C. Odmack's The Killers, 1946, and as the lynch mob leader Luke Benson in Superman and the Mole Men, 1951, when his career was stalled by almost a decade after he refused to testify before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. During those lean years, what began as an improvised speech class flourished into the Professional Actors Workshop, which taught the fundamentals of dramatic acting to such people as James Dean, Jack Nicholson, Jane and Peter Fonda, Anthony Perkins, James Coburn, Leonard Nimoy, Shirley Knight, and even Roger Corman. When Corey's screen acting career resumed in 1962, he gave some truly unforgettable performances. Mr. Ruby in Seconds, the frightening Mr. Lomax in the OBIT episode of The Outer Limits, Dick Hickok's sickly father in In Cold Blood, an aging Wild Bill Hickok in Little Big Man. He would also appear in the Night Gallery episode The Dead Man. This was Corey's second crack at directing, but it was his first directorial effort to be shown to the public. It was preceded only by an episode of the short-lived series The Psychiatrist, starring Roy Thinnes, which was not broadcast until 3 months after Certain Shadows in March 1971. He did have prior experience behind the camera, however. He had been honored 3 times for his work as a motion picture combat photographer during World War II. It's worth noting that even though Corey openly referred to himself as a retired Red, someone who was briefly affiliated with the Communist Party, he was also a decorated war hero prior to being blacklisted by the country he served. He died in 2002 at the age of 88. Grayson Hall, which has always sounded to me like a Gothic structure located somewhere in the groves of Academe, was born Shirley Grossman in Philadelphia in 1922. Her mother, who hailed from South Africa, had been a stage actress in Yiddish theater. Grayson began acting on stage when she was 20, using the stage name Shirley Grayson. She was twice married, first to a fellow actor, and then for the second and lasting time to television writer Sam Hall, who had sold scripts to Studio One, the Philco Television Playhouse, and the United States Steel Hour, but was still something of a struggling writer. It was at the time of their marriage that Shirley Grayson became the formidable Grayson Hall, a transformation that coincided with her striking appearance as Pepe in the campy cult exploitation film Satan in High Heels. She was actually quite an avant-garde actress at this time, appearing in plays by Pirandello and Genet off-Broadway, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. on TV, and in William Klein's pop art flick Who Are You, Polly Magoo, just before she caught her big break by being cast in John Huston's The Night of the Iguana, which brought her an Academy Awards Best Supporting Actress nomination. In 1967, she was cast as Dr. Julia Hoffman on Dark Shadows, initially intended to be a brief role, but one that clung to audience approval and several different characters over some 478 live-on-tape episodes. I'm one of the proud number who have seen every single one of them, and it's impossible to watch Dark Shadows in its entirety without having not only admiration, but great empathy for all of its cast members. Above and beyond what it is, Dark Shadows embodies what it means to be an actor or involved in producing live drama. We see everyone at their very best and at their very worst, and even at places in between that are almost impossible to describe. So, yes, I love Grayson Hall, and it's a great pleasure to see her working here under more controlled circumstances. Once again, the costumes are quite loquacious in telling us about the character's inner states. The formerly colorful Rebecca is now in mourning, wearing a predominantly black dress. Her only color resides in her apron, so she's advertising herself as being helpful. And Stephen has gone from black now to gray. He was the more adroit, serious mourner when Emma was still alive and demanding bedtime readings from him all the time. Now his blacks are brightening, relaxing into grays, as it were, and he can finally exhale and admit to what has been his plan all along, to unload the house and its contents and split the profits with his 2 siblings. As the elder and the son of this house, he doesn't consult his sisters, he just barrels ahead. Even though Stephen is a kind of monster, even he must have his reasons, and Serling gives them to him in this section of the dialogue when he rails against Ellen and the way she turned this once splendid old house into a mausoleum with her clinging illness. He's been pushed by all those Dickens chapters beyond the point of caring anymore about anyone else. Now it's his time to live. Though Lewis Hayward himself would live for another 15 years, his once greatly promising screen career was very nearly at an end. A heavy smoker, he was soon diagnosed with lung cancer, and he had only one last feature and one more television show awaiting him. The film was a low-budget affair, Terror in the Wax Museum, which also starred Ray Milland, Elsa Lanchester, Maurice Evans, John Carradine, and Patrick Knowles. An outstanding cast, actually, for 1942. The Skelton and Benson book I've mentioned, Rod Serling's Night Gallery and After Hours Tour, lists both the house and certain shadows on the wall as 3.5-star segments, shows they consider to be very fine, but about which they hold slight reservations. My own reservation about this episode is this particular moment when these two characters innocently banter around the issue of poisoning, which I think shows Serling's thumb resting just a little too heavily on the scale. When Rebecca reminds Stephen to drink his tea because it will make him feel ever so much better, it's so obvious that she's poisoned him that it's hard to believe it wouldn't raise his own suspicions. And then Jeff Corey has the camera zoom toward the teapot for further emphasis, so the delicate atmosphere of the first act turns to something of a sledgehammer here. At the time this episode was filmed, Grayson Hall, who we see absorbed here in Needlepoint, rather like Joanna Pettit in The House, had just completed her roles in Aram Avakian's film End of the Road and House of Dark Shadows, a feature-length retelling of the daytime soap's initial vampire story arc. Though her character, Dr. Julia Hoffman, is killed off in the movie, she would live on in the parallel time of the television series, where she remained gainfully employed until the very last episode. In 1971, she returned as a different character in Night of Dark Shadows, and after the show's cancellation later in that year, she dealt for a time with the hard facts of typecasting. She had a brief role in a made-for-TV horror adventure, Gargoyles, which was fairly well received. The remainder of her TV career is negligible, the better portion of her remaining work taking place on stage. On Broadway, she was featured in Tom O'Horgan's staging of The Leaf People and a revival of Weill and Brecht's Happy End. And finally, an off-Broadway production of The Madwoman of Chaillot with Geraldine Page, Carrie Nye, and Madeline Sherwood. As with Lewis Hayward, lung cancer was her downfall. She died in 1985 at the age of 62. When Rebecca admits to Anne that she's ground up some of the sedative tablets and put them in Stephen's tea, Richard Prince's musical score rears up in horror, but it's hard to believe that anyone would be that delayed in their comprehension of events. Though Mary Wilkins' story dates back to 1903, the archetype of two completely dotty old sisters who go around poisoning people was popularized by Arsenic and Old Lace, a hugely successful 1939 play by Joseph Kesselring. It was famously filmed by Frank Capra in 1943. The same archetype can be found in Dear Charlie, written by Blanche Hanalis, or a 1961 episode of The Barbara Stanwyck Show, starring Milton Berle, Lorene Tuttle, and Catherine Squire, a story of how two elderly and wealthy sisters decide to rent their father's old room after he passes to another suitable man whom they might pamper. The new tenant, a gold digger, decides to play the two sisters against one another, leading them to poison one another, but the family cat ends up having the last laugh. That episode was directed by none other than Jacques Tourneur, best known for the original Cat People and I Walked with a Zombie, who only 5 years or so later would find himself directing a comedy about poisoning and working once again with the very same cat in the 1963 film The Comedy of Terrors. It's a small and deeply interconnected world.
I'm so glad.
Grayson Hall and Rachel Roberts are absolutely wonderful in this closing bit, but then the camera pans toward what should have been a very chilling closing image, but it doesn't quite work. As you can see, Brother Stephen's shadow was never really added to the wall. Instead, his shadow was cast onto the wall by Lewis Hayward, sitting somewhere off-screen in a rocking chair, and the image is briefly seen in motion before it is paused, the very second the camera stops moving. Why the brother's shadow couldn't have been painted there like the other one defies reason, so I can only imagine that time ran out, as often happens in the world of television production. But the real zinger is not the shadow, but rather Lewis Hayward's closing voiceover, which tells us that Brother Stephen has been damned by his actions to an eternity of reading the complete works of Charles Dickens to his sister. And so ends this night gallery look at a couple of the stranger avenues of the real estate market. There were still one or two gems ahead in season one, namely The Doll and the Emmy-winning They're Tearing Down Tim Riley's Bar, and season two would hold many more interesting treats in store, especially the H.P. Lovecraft adaptations of Pickman's Model and Cool Air. I'm Tim Lucas, asking you, please don't touch the paintings. They're still wet. Thanks for listening and watching with me.